Thank you for Alvin for sharing a little bit about Yom Kippur. That was just celebrated on Tuesday and Wednesday of this past week in the Jewish tradition. And thank you, Anna, for incorporating that into our worship service. We'll be also revisiting that next week as we look at the implications of, from one perspective, from the Jewish tradition of the Day of Atonement and repairing relationships and our ability to not only hurt and have painful relationships, but also our ability to heal and have positive relationships. This morning, though, we focus on words, and as I promised the kids, we were going to work on it, so we have to now. So if you don't want to work on words, I guess just take a break and, you know, do some words on Facebook or Twitter or something like that for a little while. There is a little poem that is often heard, and I think it probably was a poem that I heard a lot growing up. It's really short, two lines, and I would say, I remember saying it and hearing it said, and as an adult reflecting back on it, just being horrified by these two little lines. So I'm going to share them with you. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never break me or harm me. Have you heard that before? All right. It's reported to have appeared for the first time in the Christian Recorder on March of 1862, which is a publication of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And it's presented there in that publication for the first time as an old adage. In other words, it's been said over and over again. So I think back about that phrase, those two lines, and I have a problem with a couple of parts of it. One, what is going on in a playground in the 1860s that sticks and stones are the thing they are using against each other? So that's one problem I have with it. Like, what is happening on these playgrounds? All right, so the other part is the way it ends. Words will never harm me, or words will never break me. So I want you to think back on your history and playing outside or playing indoors, doing different things and activities or sports or various things where you may have gotten hurt, bumps, or bruises along the way, and see if you can remember some of those most significant ones. Maybe you broke an arm at a very pivotal age, or maybe you had some kind of injury that you dealt with that was very traumatizing. Do you remember all of the bumps and bruises growing up? Do you have them named and memorized? Probably not. So I want you to think back on your history now and think about some of the words that hurt you along the way. Think about your childhood. Think about your teen years. Think about early adulthood. Think about where you are right now in life and some of the words that have been hurled in your direction. That's a different kind of pain. That's a pain that we can still remember even to this day. Probably more significant pain often than the bumps and bruises that we get from the sticks and the stones in our lives. It's just not true. Words hurt. That's the bottom line. And if words hurt, then we have a responsibility, as you use, to do something about that with our words. There's a Japanese scientist by the name of Masaru Emoto that performed some pretty fascinating experiments on the effects of words and the energy that they have. When frozen, water that's free from all impurities will form these beautiful ice crystals that look exactly like snowflakes under a microscope. And water that's polluted or has additives like fluoride will freeze without forming any crystals. So in his experiments, Emoto poured water into vials labeled with negative phrases like, I hate you, or be afraid, and would speak that as he poured those in. And after 24 hours, the water was frozen and no longer crystallized under the microscope. It yielded gray, misshapen clumps instead of beautiful lace-like crystals. In contrast, Emoto placed labels that said things like, I love you, or peace, and spoke those into the water as he poured them into vials. And after 24 hours, they produced gleaming, perfectly hexagonal crystals. Emoto's experiments showed that there is some possibility that energy generated by positive or negative words can actually change the physical structure of an object. Now, I don't know. I haven't tested that yet, nor do I know if that was even, I haven't run that by Scopes either, so I'm sure that some of you can look that up and see if that actually happened, or you could try it at home yourself. But the truth be told, we know that words have the ability to affect us, not just emotionally, but physically. I'm sure that if we remembered and allow ourselves to remember some of the most painful words that have been said to us in our lives, we would be able to locate that pain somewhere in our body where we feel it, where we are able to experience it physiologically, not just emotionally. And it's important for us today because we are living in a day and age where words are used like weapons. There's a British politician in the 1930s who said, "Handle them carefully, for words are more powerful than atomic bombs." And certainly we can celebrate the freedom of speech, but we have to realize that words can often be costly. They are not free. I read an interesting article of a high school English teacher that invites her 11th grade students to do an inventory of their social media accounts. In other words, they, in this inventory, look at all the words and the phrases and the images that they use over and over again and keep an inventory of things that they use more often than others, and then ask the question, how do these words or phrases reflect who you are? So I thought, well, I'll give that a try. And I will say that shortly into that experience, and I only use Facebook. I'm not much on Twitter or other forms of social media. But just in Facebook posts, and it's not just things that I'm saying, but also things that I'm reposting. We're responsible for that as well. I began to do an inventory of words and phrases, and I had to stop. It was like, okay, well, I'm failing the test here. And so I just decided, since I know many of your social media accounts, I would just do an inventory of yours instead. That was much easier to do. And so if you look on the back of your program, I posted, I'm just kidding. I'm not into shaming anyone today, but you know who you are. But we are living in a day where it feels like that's very ineffectual, in a sense, that there is no consequence. I can post something, or I can say something, or I can put something out there. But really, do the words that we use, do the words that we share, do the posts that we share, do the phrases and the images that we are constantly barraging ourselves with and others around us, do they truly reflect who we want to be? Now, we certainly know that oftentimes they are in response to someone else using words or phrases that really anger us and get us, as we justify it, as righteous anger, which I think is fine. But we still have a responsibility for our words. Our celebration this month is of our very first principle, as you use, which is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And that is the test for us as we do our inventory and think about our own words. Do our words sync up with this value, or do they work against it? Do what we say over and over again in our words support this principle or undermine it? Now, certainly we have done a tremendous amount of work, and I believe for the most part we are practicing the best that we can in most of our words, but there is also room to grow even more. Dr. Daryl Wing Su is a professor of psychology at Columbia University in New York, and his work is really great for us here in our UU congregation, because we take pride in being culturally sensitive, accepting, welcoming, and affirming, so maybe we don't practice overt acts that undermine dignity and worth. But Darrell Wing Sue invites us to look at microaggressions. And he describes that as everyday slights and insults, invalidations that marginalized people experience in their day-to-day actions with well-intentioned individuals who are often unaware that they have engaged in a microaggressive act. Darrell Wing Sue is, historically, his parents are Asian, but he was born in Portland, Oregon. So he describes some of his experience with microaggressions, and I'll share them. He says once he was in a cab at an airport and was paying the cab driver, and the cab driver said, "Wow, you speak English really well." To which he replied, "Of course I do. I was born in Portland, Oregon." And the cab driver was like, "No, you weren't." Someone else, after one of his conferences, came up to him and said, "Where were you born?" "Portland, Oregon." "I get that. That's where you live. But where were you born?" "Portland, Oregon." "All right. But what country were you born in?" "The United States." You know, so that experience, and it was really an attempt to build relationship. And he says that the cab driver was in an attempt to give a compliment, but even not in an overt act of trying to hurt someone. We are communicating something that is a microaggression that we may not even be aware is harmful with the way we're saying it. In other words, there's communication that we work on all the time here in our UU congregation that is conscious and overt, but Dr. Sue says there is a meta-communication that's happening with some of the words that we use that is unconscious and undermines it constantly. We can say, and he prepares for everything as he's been working on this for 20 years, we can say that, well, people are just too sensitive today. But usually people who say they are just too sensitive are coming from a place of privilege that says, I don't have to be as sensitive as everyone else. And truth be told, the language that we use reflects the worldview of the person, even if it's an unconscious worldview that we are experiencing. As he's done some work with various businesses across the country, he has talked about an experiment that he does with CEO. He has a video, three videos of a CEO doing exactly the same thing, pounding a fist on the desk and saying, "I need these reports right away." One is of a white man, male as a CEO, a black male as a CEO, and a female CEO. The white man, the constant thing that is in response to watching that video, people say, "He is a strong leader." Already people are shaking their heads. I haven't even shared the other two things, but you know what's coming, don't you? The black male doing exactly the same thing, the common response is, "He is an angry leader." And when the female CEO does exactly the same thing, the common response is, "She is being really bitchy." Now, those are not my responses. I just need a disclaimer there. But wow. And these are folks, these are not the people that we would marginalize out on the sides of society that are yelling insults and hurls. These are the folks, the educated people who are trying to educate themselves on culture and grow, but are still allowing the underlying worldview to have a voice and maybe not even aware of it. It gives another example of a client that was in a therapy session with a therapist, a very good therapist. Maybe we won't decide that after this. But the client disposed that she was lesbian and into women and wanted to have a space to talk about that and was afraid that she wouldn't feel safe to share that. So the therapist, trying to assure her that she could, that therapist could handle it, he let her know that she is in a safe space, that he's worked with lots of people, and he's even worked with a client who confessed that she was into dogs. And Dr. Sue says there's an implied thing that's happening there that's really important to pay attention to, that even if we are saying with our words, we are welcoming, we are affirming, there is an underlying worldview that there is a deviant behavior happening, maybe even pathological. He has a professor friend who is blind, and people, students and colleagues, will often come up to him and yell at him because he's blind. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with Hispanic Heritage Month, that if you just speak English loud enough, right, then everybody in every language can hear it. And even though that's comical to watch, Dr. Sue says that what's really happening there is that the underlying worldview that's having a voice in this situation, even if it's unconscious, is that this person's disability becomes defined to every aspect of their being. If they're blind, then they also must have trouble with other things as well. Some basic assumptions about these microaggressions, and I'll just read, he's got six of those, which I can share later, but I'll just read the first two, which are really important. He says, one, we have been socialized into a society in which there exist individual, institutional, and societal biases associated with race, gender, and sexual orientation. That is not something that we can change. We have been socialized into that society. And then number two is very important. None of us are immune from inheriting those biases. None of us. No matter how much work that we have done on ourselves, none of us are immune to those biases creeping up in microaggressions. He often uses an African proverb in his conversations and teachings with others, and the African proverb says, "The true tale of the lion hunt will never be told as long as the hunter is the one telling the story." And he invites us to think about that proverb because the work involved in being able to overcome the microaggressions in our life are our ability to risk the empathy to hear how it feels for someone else to experience it, to be able to hear when we are getting it wrong, even if we feel like we 99% of the time are getting it right. If we are guilty at any point of a microaggression and hurting someone from a marginalized community, when they say, "That is painful for me to hear," to be able to hold that and say, "Okay, let me hear it from your perspective. Let me not get defensive about the words that I'm using." This is how we continue to grow. The first principle is not a litmus test. You don't walk in here and go, once you support the inherent worth and dignity of every person, you are christened a UU. It is not a litmus test. But it is an ideal that calls us to be greater than we are right now. You and I, in this place, are committing to being lifelong learners, striving toward being a people who, with words and actions, truly believes and practices a belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all. May we continue to grow toward that ideal.